Okay, my name is Liza Rozier, and this is Washington County Museum. Today's date is May 7th, 2013, and this is an oral history interview. So, first of all, we'll begin with your full name and date of birth and where you were born.
Full name, Roderick Lou Bunnell, B-U-N-N-E-L-L. Date of birth, August 4th, 1930, and at Emanuel Hospital in Portland.
Okay, and what is the family heritage on both of your sides, if you know?
Well, British Isles, with a great deal of variety in location and timing.
Do you know when your family came to Oregon? Or Oregon Territory, I should say.
Well, the a part of them came in the late 1840s, 1850s, in the covered wagons. And others came by railroad later on, and... So it spreads over time that when they arrived, the Bunnell ancestors were in the covered wagons, and one of the ancestors and one of my grandmother's sides guided the wagon train.
Wow, cool. Do you know what her name was?
Nichols.
Hattie Nichols.
Yeah.
Okay. And let's talk about your grandfather. What was his name?
Well, one grandfather was Zachariah Barnard Brown. He was born in New Brunswick. And his mother grew up in Maine, and he and his brothers would, as they got older, would go down to Maine and visit their grandparents, because schools were free in Maine, and they had to pay in New Brunswick. And so they went down for school, and so he pretty much grew up in Maine.
So they would travel back and forth just to go to
school? They traveled back and forth, yeah. One of his older brothers lied about his age and volunteered in the Army in the Civil War.
Went in very young, huh?
And Grandpa, beginning in Maine, got in the logging business and came out west as a logger in California, and then came up north to visit his brother, who was still in the Army, or was in the Army again, actually, and was stationed at Fort Walla Walla. And got up there and discovered that this was 1877, and the Army was off chasing Chief Joseph, so his brother wasn't around. So he went on up to Spokane. He'd heard there was some timber up there, and he looked around, decided there wasn't enough timber around there to be worthwhile. So he got a short job for the Army doing some cruising, and then went off to southwestern Washington, where there were more trees. In the process, he was offered, while he was in Spokane, offered a home to split a fellow's homestead right around the falls over downtown Spokane. Grandpa could have had half of it. He decided there weren't enough trees around there to make it worthwhile, so he went off and settled in Pacific County, right in the southwest corner of Washington.
Interesting. So now the story about Portland's electric streetlights, that's the same grandfather?
That's the other grandfather.
Okay, and what was his name?
His name was Bunnell, John Frederick Bunnell, I believe.
Okay.
And he was born probably down the Oregon City area somewhere, although his family got up in the Tualatin area at some time later. But the story about the lights was that the electricity first came to Portland as a civic project for street lights and streetcars and so on. And they had the generator for the streetcars. Somebody decided they should replace the gas lamps in the city with electric lights, and one of the city officials figured out that the electric lights are so much brighter that they wouldn't need as many of them, but they have to get them higher, so they get one high and high, and they have one light that would illuminate all of downtown Portland.
Nice.
And just getting a light that high wasn't a problem, because there were lots of loggers around that knew how to cut tall trees and set them up as spar poles and so on. This was back in the highly logging days. And so they had the loggers cut a Douglas fir many, many feet tall, drag it into Portland, stand it up in the main intersection, and with the street light on top. And when it got dark, they turned the light on, and you could just about see it up there.
I mean,
it's a complete botch is an idea of trying to light downtown Portland. It was completely worthless, so they realized they'd have to drop the log again and get it out of there. The problem was that was the most expensive lamp they had, and if they dropped it, the way loggers drop trees, it would smash. And so my grandfather was apparently a young man around town at the time, and he volunteered, and I don't remember if he got paid $10 or $20, but he shinned his way up 100 some feet up the pole, got the lamp, and brought it back down again.
Interesting.
And he was apparently quite the figure around Portland for a few weeks, but he left soon after and spent the rest of his year up in mid-Columbia area in Klickitat County.
Doing work up there, logging, things like that?
No, he was a farmer, a rancher.
What kind of crop?
Well, they did mostly hay and cattle and then sheep and hay, and that, of course, led to a controversy between the sheepmen and the cattlemen.
Oh, yeah. Over the ranch land?
Well, over the grazing. Sheep have incisor front teeth, and they can cut the grass much closer to the ground. And after the sheep have been through a pasture, the cows can't get anything to eat, or the horses.
That makes sense. That's interesting. That's crazy. I could ask 10 more questions just on that whole subject, you know. So let's go on to your parents. What were their names? Let's start with your father's name and date.
My father's name, Clarence Orville Bunnell. He was born in Centerville, Washington, in Klickitat County, and grew up, his younger years in a farm along the Columbia River where the Maryhill Museum is now. And that was their farm, and I think he lived there till he was 14 or 15. And he was born in 1891, I believe, and died in 1951, just short of his 60th birthday. Mm-hmm. And
your mother's name? And
mother's name was Lulu Maud Brown Bunnell. Mm-hmm. And she was born in South Bend in Pacific County and grew up there. Her father was started out in the lumber, and then he had a bad leg from a logging accident, and so he became a cruiser and doing that kind of clerical work, mm-hmm, in the lumber trades, and then got into local politics and I think he set the record in Pacific County for being longer in office than anybody else. Started out as deputy sheriff, then sheriff, and then auditor and assessor, and went through all the offices.
All kinds of different jobs.
Yeah.
Interesting. Can you elaborate on the kind of upbringing you had? I know that's kind of a broad question, but maybe, you know, religion, politics, kind of any major mottos or morals that your parents really instilled?
Well, the kind of the interesting thing in that area, so I grew up during the Great Depression. My dad's, mm-hmm, career was with Pacific Power and Light. He started out as an engineer, surveyor, and had worked his way up to assistant to the chief engineer by the time I was born. Then the Depression hit, and they reduced staff very substantially, and he had a number of 10% salary reductions and was fortunate to keep his job at all.
Interesting.
He ended up in what they called right-of-way and claims, that he would be in charge of buying right-of-way. But there wasn't any construction going on, so there was very little mm-hmm of that during the Depression. But
how did that affect farming, for his own farm?
Well, no, he didn't have a farm.
So that was just your grandparents that had the farm,
and actually, they sold that when he was 13, 14 years old and moved to Idaho.
Oh,
and he did his high school years in southern Idaho, and then came back to Washington to college at Washington State.
Idaho to Washington State. You mentioned the Depression, so we talked about that, and then so that really affected kind of the status of the whole region, I'm sure. And what do you remember about going to high school in Hood River, maybe during the 1940s?
Well, just a bit before.
You want to go back?
Before we get to there, we lived in Portland when I was a very small boy, and I was technically an only child, but when I was a couple of years old, one of my aunts died, and my mother took in her three daughters, which were older than I, three girls older than I by 4-year increments, and 4, 8, and 12 years older than I. And so I grew up with three big sisters, but interesting thing here is that when I was 6 years old, we'd been living in Portland. I'd gone to kindergarten in Portland. We moved to an obscure, tiny town in central Washington that nobody had ever heard of, which later became world famous. But so I started the first grade in Hanford,
mm-hmm.
and went first and second grades in Hanford, and which was...
Maybe explain a little bit about the town for people that might listen that don't know about it.
Well, I think everybody knows, has heard about the Hanford Project, mm-hmm. and the Hanford radioactive issues and so mm-hmm. on. But Hanford, before the war, was just a tiny little village. The downtown area consisted of a grocery store and a library that was open Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturday mornings, and a tavern, and that was about it.
And that tiny little town.
It was a very, very tiny little town, and it was...
What did all the kids do for fun around there? Just kind of play games and play outside?
Well, played. There was a lot of space to run around outside, and the town had been built by a real estate developer, and he didn't sell nearly all the property he had, so the houses were scattered out. There was lots of free space and vacant lots between the houses, so there was lots of room to have games and play outdoors.
Did you ride a lot of horses or anything?
We didn't have horses. My dad grew up in the horse era and had all the cowboy skills, but when he was in the service during the First World War, on two different occasions, he had horses roll on him, and mm-hmm. both times he was off doing things that were outside of the assignment, so he didn't want to report the injury. So the end result was he never rode again. And so I never learned. He taught me to lasso and some of the other cowboy skills, but he never taught me to ride. And so I never
scared for your safety. What a good dad. Let's talk a little bit more about his occupation with Pacific Power and Light. What? So kind of what did he do for them?
Well, he worked up to right away in claims and assistant to the chief engineer. And then when he moved to Hanford, they moved into marketing, and the idea was to build an electricity on the farm marketing program. And the Hanford area was one of the most highly electrified farming areas in the West because it had been developed just mm-hmm. in empty land by a developer who built a place where you get a run of water to run a generator in the Priest Rapids, and then pumped water out of the river and into an irrigation system in the Priest Rapids Valley, and also cut lines and sent electricity out to the farm so they could pump water out of the ditches. Mm.
Huge project.
Farming, so that... The developer that set this up went broke and they declared bankruptcy. And the biggest claimant was General Electric for the cost of the generators. And General Electric found itself owning these similar situations all over the West. So they formed them into electric companies, Pacific Power and Light, Northwestern Electric, mm-hmm. all over the West. Companies that were formed by General Electric, and finally the federal laws made them break them apart, and so they were no longer a single company, but were separate units.
That's interesting.
And he worked the electricity on the farm, and then now this was during the Roosevelt era, and part of Roosevelt's plan was to nationalize the electric business.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was going to, he planned to have all of the electric companies taken over by local PUDs, and then he would have the federal government build dams and on the rivers and furnish electricity cheaper than they could make it themselves in the private market and pay taxes. And so this became Dad's main function for a while was working on these PUD campaigns, trying to defeat the election when they would set up a county PUD and have an election to take over the power company. And so that one of the things I grew up with was the family was always in a political controversy, and there are people on both sides and arguments and so on. And so I, this is one of the things I grew up with, that you hear it at home, you don't talk about anywhere. I keep quiet about it and never say anything about it, and get used to taking shots from outsiders. Early in my first grade, some girl told me, I remember this very well, that it snowed and my mother bought me a pair of boots, and she said, well, you can have new boots because your daddy steals from the farmers.
I love it. And she's only 6 years old and she's telling you this?
And she heard it at home.
Let's go into your father's dealings with the Klickitat. And speaking the language and your story.
I understand that the Chinook referred to as it started out originally, or so they claim, as the language of the Chinook tribes along the Pacific Rim. But as the explorers and traders came in, it began to expand, and it became kind of the lingua franca of the entire trade area of the West. And included Russian words and French words and English words and Spanish words. All the different explorer groups added words to it, and it became very different from the original Chinook tribe language. But it was the common tongue that everybody spoke. Dad had a knack for languages that, unfortunately, I didn't inherit. But he could speak a number of languages and was literate in several of them, and Chinook was among the languages that he spoke. And
what other languages did he speak?
He read and write French and speak several dialects of French.
Wow.
And Spanish, Italian, Serbian, Croatian.
That would make sense considering his time in Europe. Mm-hmm.
And a little German. Not much of the Scandinavian languages, but and several Indian languages in addition to the Chinook.
Interesting.
But
so, did he have many friends, or what were his like? What are the stories revolving his dealings with them? Was it trade relationships? Was it to do with the Pacific Power Company?
When he was growing up, as I say, they had their ranch there along the Columbia. And the tribes from the east would be coming down to Columbia to fish and trade for fish.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a convenient stopover at their ranch, so the Indians would stop, and so some of them would stay for a week or so. And so he got acquainted with them, picked up some language, and began to collect their stories, their folklore. And got interested in that and got a pretty good collection of stories that he picked up. And then one particular source was a lady in Hood River named Martha Alec, and it's spelled four or five different ways, but so you can't misspell it.
Mm-hmm.
But
like A L A K, probably, or
E L L I K, and
E L L I K,
A L E X, and a variety of ways, including on the family's tombstone. There's three or four spellings on their tombstones. But at any rate, Martha was very elderly when I knew her, and she lived just east of Hood River in a little one-room house, actually two-room. There's a bedroom and a kitchen, and that was it. But Martha was very interested in preserving the culture, and it seemed to her that all the people younger than her were trying to join the American culture and give up their own. And so she was very enthusiastic about somebody like Dad that was collecting the folklore. And so she was very helpful with that. And this also led to the situation I mentioned earlier where I was sold to the Indians.
And tell us about that story.
Well, Dad, as I say, was buying right away for the power company, and they were building a line from Hood River to the Dalles. But instead of going along the edge of the river like the highway does, he was going over the hills in between, over the mountains in between. And just east of Hood River, the hills right against the valley, is a patch of land that is still owned by an Indian band, and it's called Indian Mountain, and there's an Indian encampment up there, I think they're officially part of one of the reservations, but the land is technically trust land that is held by the government on behalf of the Indians. And the line went across this land, and Dad went up to talk to them, and none of them were interested in giving right away because somebody had told them that the wind whistling through the wires would kill their horses. And this was completely untrue, and Dad tried to explain it was untrue and show them, but just got nowhere. Well, Martha, his friend Martha Alex, and they called her Indian Martha, which was not a term of denigration, incidentally. That you know, a lot of respect, but she was had done a lot of work as a practical nurse for families in Hood River, and was well known for that. But Indian Martha offered to help him. She said she'd bring the key people into her cabin and have them meet with him. And well, I was 4 or 5 years old, and he took me along with him when he went up there to the meeting with Martha and the Indians. And I remember we got into this room, maybe twice as big as this one, but we were in this room with sitting on the floor in a circle. Everybody just sitting cross-legged on the floor, and Dad and me and Martha and all the Indians. Well, there was one woman in the group of the Indians, all men except one woman. And
that was Martha or a different woman?
A different.
Okay.
A woman from up in the band on the hill. And this says something that people don't recognize now, that the women in the tribes were very influential, not in combat, but in hunting, but in food and any negotiation the women would be involved in. And this Dad tried to get him interested. There was a young a white man that visited Martha from time to time, and he had developed a written form of their local language, and it had translated one of the chapters of Dad's book into it, and he read that out of Dad's book to him in the local language, and they were all interested, then Dad had brought the money, because they didn't trust banks, he brought the money to buy the right-of-way, and all the forms, and the maps, and spread it all out. They wouldn't have anything to do with it, unless this one woman that was, she was the key, and if she didn't move, none of them would move. And she just sat there with her head down, her arms folded, and would not even look up. It was just a dead issue as far as doing any business, because she just wouldn't move. Finally, Dad put his hand on me and says, "Klahaya Lemya," that's, "how are you? Hey there, old woman, old mother, what did you give me for the boy?" Now, they were talking in Chinook, but I knew exactly what was going on. I never understood the language. Well, she came alive. She pulled me over, sat me on her knee, and, "Oh, spookum papoose." she says, "Four ponies." And Dad said, "Oh, a big boy like that ought to be worth at least 8 ponies." "Spookum papoose. 6 ponies?" Dad says, "Well, do I get to pick the ponies?" Well, all the rest of the Indians all laughed, broke out laughing, because apparently she had a reputation for sticking people with bad horses.
Oh, no.
And so this, I mean, he nailed it right there. Everybody, all of a sudden it was fun. Everybody was having a good time. There were offers and counteroffers going back and forth. And people were making deals, and she was involved. Everybody was talking, having a good time, except possibly for me. I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life up on Indian Mountain, but
doing hard labor somewhere, you know.
But at any rate, after an hour, Dad had the sign right away. They had the money, and he had me.
And it all worked out right. Okay.
Everything worked out right. And as he would tell the story, he said, "I grabbed hold of his hand, wouldn't let go until we're up into the car."
So that you knew you were at least going home with your dad. That's funny. Any other stories about him and them that you can think of?
Well,
just off the top of your head?
There's a lot of stories about Dad's involvement with the Indian. One of them I particularly remember because I have somewhere a record of 78 where this the KON radio did a radio program on it, and I have the record. But he was in the Dalles on business, and went by one of the taverns, noted there was a lot of Indians, went in and visited with some of them. And there's one old man, I think it was Chief Tommy Thompson, who wanted to get back to Hood River, to the band, and was looking for a ride. And so Dad said, I'm going that way, come on with me. Well, they got just beyond Mosier, where the road, the old road used to go up the side hill west of Mosier. And in the loops, there is some very interesting archaeological evidence of early occupation. There's a slide of rocks, big rocks, but they've been jacked around it, and so they're into trenches and ridges and mounds and so on along this slide. And something that, if the trees were all down, it was something you could see for miles up and down the river. And so Dad stopped and wanted to know if Chief Thompson knew anything about it. He got very, very close. He wanted to get out of there. He wanted to leave right now. Hmm. And those were the people that could change. The people that were there were the ones that were here before the Indians came and were here when the Indians got here. And they had the ability to change themselves into animals or trees or bushes or make themselves invisible. And didn't want anything to do on it, just wanted to get out of there as fast as possible.
Wow.
And, I mean, this many years later, he's still, well, now, of course, the Indian tradition is that they were the first ones here and there was nobody here before them. And
they were like the fathers of the country.
Kind probably of. Read some of the controversy about the Kennewick man that they discovered.
Kenneth Ames, and he was the archaeologist that... But, studied the whole Kennewick man.
But they found the skeleton that goes back several thousand years, the DNA is not related to the Indians, it's related to Asian.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
So it's a big controversy because of the Repatriation Act.
Should the skeleton be given to the Indians to bury and so on? And
they just found Joseph Meek's, supposedly four of his children are buried out in Hillsborough.
Mm-hmm.
And Judy Goldman, who's one of our board members, I just saw a thing on Monday about that, and I thought that was interesting. That has a lot to do with local history. So let's keep going. Tell us about the 1894, the high water mark.
Oh, well, another time when I was traveling with Dad when I was preschool, we were in the Dalles, and he noticed that they were tearing down the last remaining wall of the Umatilla House Hotel. Now, the Umatilla House was kind of the legendary inn at the Dalles in the early days,
mm-hmm.
where if you had the money, this is the right place to stay and the right place to eat and so on. And they were tearing down this last wall, and the wall had a watermark from the height of the 1894 flood, and this was, as far as Dad could see, was the only building in town still standing that had that watermark. So he had a survey crew in the area at the time, and he had them come over and measure how high the watermark was above the ground, and then run a line of levels to the new post office, the other end of town, up that high up on the wall of the post office, and set a brass marker like these set benchmarks on the side of the post office. Now the post office has since moved to another building, and it's on the other side of the street now. But we were up in the Dalles a year or so ago and looked around. The mark is still there on the old building. But if you walk up several steps up from the sidewalk to a kind of patio in the front of the old post office, and then over beside the door, more than head high. I think that's how deep the water was in 1894. And,
so deep.
And that, if that much water came down again, would all the dams be able to control it, or who knows? Hope we never have to find out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, look at Vanport. You know, of course, that was 48. That was before even like.
Well, there
a couple of the dams.
Yeah,
were up,
there were a couple
of
dams,
but still, that's. Scary to think about all that water coming down from the mountain every year, you know. Okay, so let's go on. You explained about the levels, and then let's talk a little bit. You mentioned your father's role in World War One. Did he have any kind of role during the Second World War?
No, he
And you would have been too young.
Pardon?
You were too young to be drafted. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just a little kid, but mm-hmm. this gets into a political situation because he had become well known by this time as the spokesman for the anti-nationalization of the electric business. Mm-hmm. And as such, a Democrat administration, he was not welcomed in military service. And why this is, but the word was out that he was not would not be accepted. So there were a number of his friends, people that had served with him, and so on, were in, but he was not acceptable for some reason. And so,
so did he work? What did he do during the war? Just saying, he just still worked for the power company.
Worked with the power company, and these controversies went on. When we moved to Hood River, the reason we moved there was they formed a PUD in Hood River and went on the ballot. And there was some kind of a loophole in the Oregon law that if they could get a big enough bond levy from Hood River, they could buy the entire state of Oregon Pacific Power Light facilities. And so there was something like the Hood River PUD had a $117 million bond issue, and Dad was heading the team that was opposing it, and the local area manager was very much involved and had a heart attack and died, and they appointed Dad his replacement. And so we had lived in Yakima at that time. We moved to Hood River and during the war, and so we were there when the Japanese came back. We weren't there when they shipped the Japanese out. But
what was the atmosphere like when they came back?
Very mixed. There was a lot of Hood River was kind of the high point of the anti-Japanese feeling in Oregon, and to the extent that the American Legion went out and erased all the Japanese names off the honor roll that was on the courthouse, the local people that were in the service, and these are guys that were in combat in Europe at the time, and doing very well, many of them wounded, some of them killed, and but their names were painted out, and
how did you feel about?
Well, I felt it was wrong, and my dad did. My dad belonged to the American Legion, and because he had all this other political stuff going on, he just had to keep quiet. He couldn't take a leadership position on this, so he just had to do his best to keep out of that controversy.
So we talked about their attitudes towards the Japanese and then, of course, towards Native Americans. Do you know kind of what either of your parents' attitudes towards Latino population or African Americans?
There was very, very little of this. Almost no Latino population in the area until the Bracero.
Braceros after World War II.
Mm-hmm. Situation came along. But, and there were very few, in the areas where we lived, very few African Americans. Mm-hmm. My mother had one friend during the war. She substituted in schools. That was the time when married women did not teach school, and after she was married, she quit teaching. But she substituted during the war, in a part of Yakima. We were living in Yakima, and the school she was substituting in was the area where the railroad African Americans lived, and so she had some African American children and became friends with one of the mothers, and so we saw something of her and something of that family.
So you had pretty good opinions then, since you knew them and spent time with them, so you didn't. There wasn't any like animosity or anything.
Regarding the Japanese, the interesting situation here was when they came back. this was during the summer, and there was all this resistance and bad publicity going on, and the people in the Japanese community were very concerned about their children going to school. And so when high school started that fall, this was my first year in high school, there were only two Japanese students came out of the whole Japanese community, came to school that first day. And actually both of them became good friends later on, and one of them is still alive. I see him now and then in, at reunions, but that it was very, very interesting that the two of them sat there and nobody bothered them, and nobody, but on the same token, nobody got up and got friendly with them, and they just sat there. And
probably kind of an indifference, not really knowing what to say or how to act.
As a lady I worked with for many years, I hadn't realized she was from Hood River, and visiting with her one time, and she had been high school age at that time, and her parents had sent her over to Washington, one of the communities across the river, to go to high school. Not go to school in Hood River because of the ill will.
That was a pretty big hub for anti-Japanese. So we'll go forward a little bit. Well, actually, first of all, I was going to talk a little bit about the building of the dam in 51, or excuse me, I think it was 57 was the building of the dam, because you mentioned you might know a little bit about the silo.
Well, yeah, that the Celilo village was there, of course, until the dam was built. And driving back and forth, we frequently stop off at Celilo, and Dad would go in and visit with some of the Indians. And if you walking up and down the little trail between the houses, if you met an Indian, hand him a dollar and pointed out which car was yours, you got back, there'd be a salmon in the trunk of your car.
Wow.
So we always laid some newspaper on the floor of the trunk so that...
Just in case. As long as you have that dollar, right? How did your father feel about the building of the dam?
Well, now that was after he had died. That the
Oh, that's right. He died in 51.
But the Bonneville was built...
during the 30s, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Grand Coulee. And His idea was that the private companies had intended to build dams in the Columbia, and the government forced them out and took it over and built them instead. And now that the government had the dams, they would sell electricity to the PUDs and the cooperatives cheaper than they sell it to the private power companies. So they could give these people a discount, and they'd have an economic gain by throwing out the private company and nationalizing the industry. And
interesting.
So, and he also, I was reading something, reading history just recently of Grand Coulee, and it said that no one ever raised the question that when it was being built of the damage to the fish runs and so on. Mm-hmm. That's not true, because I remember Dad and his acquaintances talking about that quite frequently and quite vigorously about how this was going to really ruin the Indians and damage their economy, because they wouldn't be able to get the salmon as they had in the past.
That's interesting that here you are refuting what's been said in history.
The other thing I remember about Bonneville, about Celilo Village, it smells bad.
Oh, really? Because of all the salmon?
Well, because of the salmon, because there was no sewage, no... people just relieved themselves wherever they were, and...
You're standing on the river all day. I guess you don't want to go find an outhouse when you're right there on the water, you know.
Yeah.
Let's move on to your mom. And I just wanted to ask about her as a teacher. So what grades and subjects did she teach?
She primary, first grade or primary, depending on the school. And she...
Probably would have been all subjects at that point, right?
If you're teaching
grade school, it's kind
for,
of...
For primary, yes. Mm-hmm, one, mm-hmm. one teacher covers everything. Mm-hmm. And she...
And where did she teach?
Well, she... starting when she... started teaching would have been in Pacific County, and then she taught east of the mountains. When she and Dad met, she was teaching in Richland, and he was doing a job there, and they were living in the same boarding house, and got acquainted.
That's how they met.
In Richland, and then she...
Can you describe, like, any early memories of her? What, for example, what kind of housework she did? You know, I kind of mentioned on your list here, like baking bread or, you know.
I understand that we were an electric family, so we had electric stove and electric refrigerator, and electric vacuum cleaners and so on. Mm-hmm. And this was important. The power company sold all these things in their office. They'd have plans of them for sale. And
so did they get discounts because your father was
employed? Yeah, a discount. And it was important to let the neighbors see that we were using this sort of thing. And
kind of a sales type of thing. Yeah. Like, I'm thinking of Amway here is what I'm thinking about, you know. You set up your whole house and make it look all nice. What kind of advantages educationally do you think you had because she was a teacher? Do you feel like she...
Well, for one thing, I learned very early to speak clearly and distinctly and with proper grammar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And which leads to another story that because I was the one always in the class that could speak clearly, that could recite a poem, that could read the thing, teachers assumed that I could also sing well.
Wrong. Oh.
And I have no ear for music, and I can recognize the tune, and I can memorize the lyrics, but I never stay on pitch when singing. And so year after year, I'd get picked out to be part of the special singing group for the class and be dismissed after
they heard your voice. That's great. So we'll go on a little bit to your college, your career. Maybe talk a little bit about Whitman College in Walla Walla.
Well, Whitman was a little different. This is where we met, and uh-huh. So we're both at Whitman. But Whitman at that time, the student body was highly selective. You had to do very well on the Scholastic Aptitude Test to be accepted at Whitman, but the student body was made up of probably the first or second or third smartest kid in all the small high schools in the Pacific Northwest, and then a lot of from the very wealthiest families in the big cities,
mm-hmm.
and so there was an interesting mix there of the. The big city kids that had a very wealthy background, and those of us from the small towns that kind of were squeezed to be able to go to Whitman.
And what did you study at Whitman?
My major was English.
Okay. And that, so in turn, you ended up at Lewis Clark doing law school, right?
Actually, before it was Lewis and Clark.
Before Whitman?
Well, before the law school. So the law school that when I went was an independent, just organized many years before by a group of lawyers and judges, and operated in a downtown office building, a grungy old building that's since been torn down. And I think it's the back part of the Benson Hotel, but there's such a crummy old building, and we were on the second and third floor was the law school, and it was strictly a night school operation. I got out of the Army. We were going to get married the next year, so I needed to find a job, so I went to Portland State and took a quarter of business-type courses, and then went out and found a job with a very small health insurance organization, mm-hmm. and over the years grew into the largest insurer in the West. But
And you stayed with them till retirement?
Yeah, right. 40 years.
Wow, what a career.
But the company was much bigger and broader by the time I left. Mm-hmm. And but at any rate, I had a job and was working, started out working in claims and various other aspects of the company, and I got it far enough into management that I realized that the guy that was the president was just taking the company in the wrong direction. It was just a loser proposition, so I figured I needed something else, and the one education that I could get and still work full-time was going to night law school, so mm-hmm. I went to night law school.
Interesting.
And he let me know that I would be out as soon as I finished and passed the bar, because he didn't want a lawyer around looking over his shoulder, and which is understandable. And fortunately, just shortly after I graduated, he got a job with a larger company and moved on, and the new president, when I came back after passing the bar, he made me general counsel and kept me in the company, and so I moved on then in management and retired as general counsel, secretary, and senior VP.
And that was in what year did you retire?
1995.
So good long 40-year history. I can't believe the changes that you must have seen in 40 years.
It was amazing because we, I think we had like $230,000 of transaction when I started. And when I left, the company was doing $5 billion a year.
And started,
we were limited to Oregon, and when I left, we were in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Utah.
It's amazing that it could spread like that over, really 4 decades really isn't that long. it seems a long time, but. What do you remember about your military service from 52 to 54, right?
Well, I got out of college, and I was going to be drafted.
This is for the Korean War, right?
This was during the Korean War. And the old-timers, the veterans that were still in college, said that do anything you can to avoid being drafted, because if you're drafted, they'll put you through basic training, then send you off to Korea as a replacement in a combat infantry outfit. And that's the worst possible assignment, because you're the new guy, you don't have anybody watching your back, you've got the worst assignments, and just a fast way to become a casualty. And so I tried several alternatives, and the one that I finally stuck with was I came into Portland in the summer and applied at the local recruiting office for what's called a civilian commitment. That is, I applied for officer candidate school, passed the physical, passed all the tests, the written, the oral, the whole thing, and got a written confirmation that I was accepted for OCS, and then enlisted in the Army for 2 years. Mm. And it didn't work out because the prerequisite was you had to go through basic training and then you go through what was called leadership school for 8 weeks. And in the process, with all the gunfire and explosion and so on, damaged my hearing to the extent that I could no longer qualify to be an officer.
Oh, no.
So I spent the second year of the Army as a clerk working in Alaska.
Oh, wow. What was it like in Alaska at that
time? Well, I just outside of Anchorage, so the weather was fine. It stayed...
That's real southern, huh? Anchorage. Yeah.
Stayed sunshine all night at some point, but it was interesting. It was Alaska was a territory then, and I had some connection, was able to spend some time with some civilians and see some of the culture of the society there, and it was an interesting situation.
Lots of local wildlife, I'm sure, and
you
see lots of bears and salmon, and I'm sure all kinds of beautiful things up there. I spent a lot of time in Canada, but never been to Alaska. So, you served? The majority of it was in Alaska, and then you just came home from there in 54.
That was about half and half. But between going through the two classes and waiting and other assignments, I spent just about the first year in California and second year in Anchorage.
Any special friends or commanders? Any stories from your service?
Well, there's a lot of good stories. At one point, we had a former child movie actor that was working in the theater across the street from our office, and he had been ordered to put on a play, and so he was in the process of putting a play together. And one of his actors quit right just shortly before the opening, and he heard that I had done some acting in high school and college, so he came over and asked me to be in his play. So I acted in his play, and part of the play was about a couple of Hollywood screenwriters who discovered that their secretary is pregnant and decided to make the baby a superstar. And you're probably not old enough to remember Baby Leroy, that was a famous Hollywood star at one point, and before my time, actually. But anyway, the opening scene of the second act of the play was the theater preview of the movie that they were making with the baby, and I played a Down at the Hills old-time cowboy movie actor who was trying to make a play for the mother and rebuild his career, and so I was the main figure in this preview. So what it all comes down to is that I acted in the first Western movie made in Alaska, which, and it was under the direction of Robert Blake.
One of your greatest achievements, right? I want to know the story about Governor Kulongowski.
Okay. Well, Ted, one of my assignments for OPS and then Blue Cross Blue Shield was to take care of the problems of the legislature, and I quickly found out what I needed to do was hire a lobbyist, because those guys are professionals, and I could go down and testify and talk to people, but I couldn't do the day-to-day stuff that they do all the time, and so I hired a lobbyist, and I was the one the lobbyist talked to, and the one that came down and talked to people for them and testified and so on. And when I first ran across Ted, he was a state senator, very much tied in with the unions, and he was pushing a bill that required that whenever a person left a group, he'd be entitled to buy an individual policy. And which was fine. That was all the legitimate companies were doing that already, so I had no problem with that. But then his bill went on and laid out what the benefits of the individual policy would be, and they were much worse than the ones companies were offering already. And so I tried to get this through to him, but the unions were pushing this bill, and he didn't mess with the unions. He didn't object to anything the unions wanted. And so I just couldn't get through to him that this was a loser, that he was taking things away from people. And he had enough clout. He got his bill passed. Well, 2 years later, Ted is insurance commissioner, and his staff comes to him and says, we've got this awful law that says people leave a group, they have to take this terrible coverage that's worse than anybody else gets, worse than they could get if they didn't have this. And he says, well, we'll have a public hearing. We'll see about changing it. So he called a public hearing, and I went down to testify, and here was the big room, Ted up there in front at the table out in front, and the staff lined up behind him at the table, and there's a television camera and microphones and so on, and then the dais out front for the out front of him where the witness would come up and talk. Well, then all the lobbyists in back, and so I, my turn to talk, I came up, I figured this is my one chance. I said, Mr. Commissioner, we knew when, actually, when Ted became the insurance commissioner, I spent a lot of time with him then, so we got very well acquainted. So
you were able to talk to him kind of on a more informal basis.
But this was the big thing with the television camera going. I said, Mr. Commissioner, we knew when this bill came before the legislature that it was a bad bill, that it was going to take benefits away from people, give them less than they already had. But there was this one senator that I tried to convince him, but I couldn't convince him. I talked to him, but this one senator kept insisting on, no matter what I said to him, even though I laid it out, he just would not understand. Finally, I clicked on Ted, what I wanted to do. They grinned, Rod, you son of a bitch.
He said that right into the microphone in front of everybody. I love it. Wonder what he thought to himself after, you know. That's, now I'm going to want to email him and say, hey, do you remember this? You know, no. That's a great story, especially considering he's still, you know, up and running today, so it's great. I will talk a little bit, don't have too much left to do, except maybe talk a little bit about your immediate family, so wife's name and place of birth, if you can.
Wife's name is Sarah Alice McMillan Bunnell. And she was born in Colville, Washington, April 12th, 1931. It was 1931.
And name and maybe birthplaces of your kids?
The oldest boy is John Colin Bunnell, and he was born in 1960, I believe. Mm-hmm. And younger brother, David Daniel Bunnell, 3 years younger. And John is still here in Portland. He's a freelance writer and editor. And has a part-time job at the grocery store to cover when the
extra
checks don't
bills.
Come in regularly, mm-hmm. and to provide his fringe benefits, mm-hmm. health insurance, and so on. And David is living in Los Angeles, actually San Pedro, and he's a high school English teacher right at the moment. Mm-hmm. He was originally a high school photography teacher, but they had cut back on their benefit and their budget, like all school districts have had to, and so he is now an English teacher with a whole lot of photography equipment in his closet.
Poor guy. Oh, at least he can put it to use on his own, right? Grandkids? Do they have kids?
John is not married. David is married. He has two children. Bronwyn is, 14 now, a freshman?
13.
What's her name?
Bronwyn.
Bronwyn?
Yeah.
Hmm, that's an interesting.
And she is very athletic. She is a freshman in a four-year high school, but she turned out for the cross-country team and made the team.
Wow.
And her team won the Los Angeles District Championship and placed eighth in the state championship.
Good girl.
But so she's running against juniors and seniors, and Reese is 3 years younger, and still in grade school, and his sports are primarily basketball and swimming. Bronwyn also plays soccer, and she I think would like to get out of the track and into soccer if she can make it.
Oh, she likes soccer better, huh? That's more of a contact sport.
Yeah.
Just a few, you know, any family vacations or specific places in Oregon that are special to you?
Well, the mountains were always special to me. I lived in Hood River. I got involved with the Hood River Crags, the mountain rescue organization, and did a lot of climbing and eventually voted into the Crags. And
that brings me into your climb on Mount Hood.
Well,
tell about that.
Actually, I climbed Mount Hood 30-some times, but...
Whoa.
But
wow. I didn't think it was that many.
equal number of times, but the various other mountains in the Coast Range that...
What is it about mountain climbing that...
Well, it is physically demanding, and it has a beginning and an end. I mean, you complete the climb and you've done it. You get to the summit, you've accomplished something, and you get back down, and there's some exciting things you go through, getting up and down and through the technology and the technique and.
What kind of gear? Over the years, did your gear change? I would assume your gear got more kind of technological as you.
Not really.
Use the same things.
Boots get. Over time, get developed and fit better, and get a little more flexible sometimes. But during the time I was climbing, the gear stayed pretty much the same. There have been some changes since. Ice axes are no longer as long as they used to be. Huh. People no longer use them as a walking stick or a cane.
Oh, gotcha. They just have the shorter ones.
So they're pretty small now, and. Crampons are lighter weight, I think, than they used to be, but that's the spikes that strap onto your boots, and
what kind of safety equipment?
Well, rope is a rope.
Well, and then did you have the same kind of, what do they call them? The hooks that you hook. What are they called? The grappling where they, you know, you can just hook it onto like the rope or.
Carabiner?
Yeah, I think, they still had those then, too?
Actually, they came along during the time I was climbing. Didn't have them when I began, but they did by the time I finished. And I see a lot of people use them for key rings now. And every time I see one, I'm like, hey, I got one of those in the basement. Mine's got 120 feet of rope tied to it.
That's great.
But the climb I think you're referring to is one I wrote something about not too long ago. And I've talked about it, but it was a climb where we got caught up in a cloud.
Oh, that's right. The lenticular cloud, right?
Lenticular cloud. This was climbing the north side rock, which is actually the east face of the mountain. Go up to Tilly Jane Camp, and this was the summer between my junior and senior years in college. And there were seven or eight of us got together going to climb the mountain. And these were all guys that had been in high school with me, except a couple of them were younger brothers of guys that had been in high school with me. So we all knew each other, and some of us had climbed together before. And I just recently been voted into the Hood River Craigrats, and so they appointed me the leader of the climbs. This is the first climb that I led on Mount Hood. And the climbing route goes up to the top of Cooper Spur. And if you look at the mountain from the north side, from the Hood River side, you notice that the left skyline drops down from the summit pretty steeply and then swings out to a little point and then goes off down into the woods. Well, that little point is the top of Cooper Spur. And so we started out 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that, went up. So it was just getting light by the time we got up to the top of the spur. And then there's a rock just beyond that. It's called Tie-In Rock. Got out there, and we got the ropes out and tied them in explained to the novices that hadn't climbed before. There were a couple of the younger brothers how you use the ice axe and how you when you fall, you do a self-arrest to stop yourself when you're falling, and how you do all this sort of thing, and explained all this, and then started up. And just got up a little ways, and we popped into a cloud. This lenticular cloud. Well, a lenticular cloud, if you're not familiar with them, is shaped like a pancake. It's a big flat surface, and except that the top and the bottom are both lumped up a little bit. They're so it's a little thicker in the middle and out toward the edges. And you find them around mountains. Apparently, the wind will blow the warm valley air up against the mountain and drive it upwards into the cold air above, and the mist freezes, and you get this freeze, and yet this lenticular shape just sits on top of the mountain. Well, we got into this, and we knew the route, we knew where we were supposed to go, and any problem being lost, and we couldn't see as much, but we knew where we were supposed to go, and went up the mountain, and it's pretty steep, as you can see on that side, steep enough that if you stand straight up and reach out your arm straight out in front of you, you can touch the snow in front of you. And try that when you're walking upstairs the next time, and you get an idea of how steep it is. And but you can go up that if you have the right equipment and manage it right. And so we got up to the summit and sat around and talked a little bit and visited and ate our lunch, and then started back down. Well, walking down a steep slope like that is something you can do if you have the right equipment and the technique. And the technique is crucial, because what you need to do is, as you're in one step forward for the next step, which is way down below you, lean forward so you drop straight down into that next step. And drive your heel back at the same time. So you'll get a good solid grip with your crampons as you come down. That's a very safe walk. The problem is that it's absolutely counterintuitive. Your natural inclination, lean back against the mountain and slide your foot out there in front. Well, that means your weight is behind your center of resistance, and so you're going to push your crampon out away from the snow, and you'll fall. Well, we explained this to the new climbers, the ones that hadn't climbed before, and even had them practice a little bit before we started down. All of them caught on, except this one younger brother just couldn't get him. Didn't click at all with him. And he started down. His big brother was right behind him on the rope, and he took 3 steps and he fell. Well, his big brother had his crampons and his ice axe. They wrapped the rope around his ice axe and jerked him to a stop. And he got 2 or 3 more steps. He fell again. Well, he just kept bouncing down.
Poor guy.
And finally, his brother got tired of this, so he let all the slack out between them. So the rope was almost tight between them. So when his brother started to slide, he would just lean back and with his own
pull
weight,
him back up.
Jerk him to a stop so he wouldn't go more than a foot or so. And so doing that, he was able to come down and keep up with the rest of us and jerk him to stop every few steps. Well, I was the leader, so I was ahead and got down where I knew we were below all the danger points. And so it'd be safe to cut loose and slide. It's called glissade. And so I told everybody to stop and then take the rope off. So I got loose first, and I started to slide. Well, within 100 feet, I came popping out of the cloud. It had a very just a sharp, vivid edge of the cloud, and I thought, all of a sudden, a bright, sunshiny day. And so I stopped and hollered to the rest of them. They're all safe to let go, and so they began to come out one by one. They came popping out of the cloud. except for little brother and big brother. And big brother called down. He said, I can't get the rope off. I jerked the knot so many times it's frozen, and it won't come untied.
Oh, no.
And so I said, well, let your trousers down and slide it over your hips. That may make your hips just that much thinner that you can slide it over them. Well, he tried it, and it worked. The only trouble was it got down to his ankle, and little brother fell again, just standing
there. Oh, no.
Jerked the feet out from under him.
Oh, no.
So the two of them came bouncing down.
And he's got no pants on.
With his pants down around his ankles.
Poor guy. Probably freezing in the snow, too, I'm sure.
I imagine. They weren't either one of them hurt, but...
a funny sight to see, I'm sure, as
you're walking. What I hadn't realized was that this was Sunday morning, and there was a church service going on at Tilly Jane Camp. The minister was on a little rise and... with his back to the mountain and all the congregation in a little amphitheater out in front of him. And these people had known they were coming up. This is how I should lift mine eyes under the hill, my strength cometh from so on, service. And they had, many of them brought their binoculars and were watching the mountain. And one of them was happily looking up there when he saw me come out of the cloud. And so he hollered at the rest of them, or whispered to the rest of them, and so they had all these goggles.
Everybody watching.
By the time Big Brother and Little Brother came out,
they probably didn't realize they had such an audience. I'm sure.
I have no idea what we did to the sermon, but when we got down there, there was this crowd of people. What were you guys really doing up there?
Up on the mountain. That's great. What a cool story about Mount Hood. I love Mount Hood. So. So, a couple, just the few last, maybe significant memories. Columbus Day storm, 1962.
The Columbus Day storm, we were living at that time in a little court apartment in Beaverton. We had bought the house we're living in now, and we're just in the process of getting ready to move when the storm hit. And I was downtown working, and... my office was downtown, but I parked up on the hill up above the Multnomah Stadium.
What kind of car did you have at the time?
Well, actually, I was driving an MGA coupe at the time.
I just had to ask. It's just a random question.
But at any rate, I walked up to the parking place and got in the car and was driving home, and I could tell that I was getting a lot of buffeting from the wind, and the car handled quite well in the wind. It wasn't a problem, but got home and I was able to park our other car. This was after John was born, so we needed two cars. Other car was a Morris Minor, and I was able to park beside it. So it was downwind, so it took some damage. There was a church down the block that had shingles blowing off, and those shingles took some paint off the Morris. But the MG was protected, and so it didn't lose any paint. But in the course of the storm, I decided I needed to check in the car to open the front door. That apparently changed the wind pressures, that the whole roof of the apartment went off.
Just because you opened the door?
When I opened the door, it went off. And now this was a tarred paper roof. And it was all the roofing went. The wood frame was still there, and the wood slats that the tar paper was nailed to were still there, but the tar paper was gone. It was over in the neighbor's yard somewhere.
Did you guys have to hunker down and kind of hide, or did you just
kind
of ride it out?
It didn't rain much that night, and it only leaked in a couple of places, and so we were able to get through. And the next morning, the owner had a crew out with tarps to spread over the building until he got the roof repaired, and it did just little or no damage to the house we were moving into, and so that was...
Well, that's good. Made for an easy move, I suppose, right? Easier rainy, right?
The scary thing is that when I back to work Monday morning, the place where I parked up the hill from the athletic club, I couldn't park there because a tree had smashed down right in the spot where the car had been. Who knows if I'd worked half an hour longer and come up... The car would have been smashed, or would smash while I was getting in, or what? It was
perfect timing,
right?
Ready to go home that day. I think that's it for some main questions. If there's any other things you want to mention that maybe I forgot about, anything you think is kind of important
there's any number of things
we could talk for a whole another 2 hours, I'm sure. So, well, let me just say thank you so much for coming and for telling us your stories. And again, yeah, maybe we can sit down again and do another hour at some point. So I'm going to go ahead and end the tape for now.
Okay.
Yay. Okay. So there's that one. And that ended up being